You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast. Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 19th to the 25th of September. I'm Lizzie Gibney. Once again, I'm standing in for Chris Parr. And today I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, deputy news editor John Morgan and reporter Paul Jump. We're going to be taking a look at some of the top stories from this week's magazine. First, we're going to discuss a very hot topic, which is the launch of FutureLearn, the UK's first massive online open platform, or MOOC. Then we're going to hear from John about his interview with NUS President Tony Pearce and some of the promises that she's trying to wrangle out of the government. And finally, we'll discuss an interesting idea that's been put forward on the blogosphere, which suggests that the government should perhaps use more academics as consultants. So that's one for Paul. But first, FutureLearn. The MOOC platform owned by the Open University, that was launched on Wednesday with, I think, a fair amount of fanfare, we can say. And Simon, what do you think we should make of it?
Well, yeah, this has been the much-anticipated launch of the UK's first MOOC platform. MOOCs, obviously, being the big buzzword for higher education and online learning over the last couple of years. Although it has come quite a long time after sort of the launch of the US-based platforms that have grabbed the headlines like Coursera, Udacity and edX. So this has kind of been a long time coming. It was actually announced a while ago, almost a year ago, did the UK universities announce that they were going to launch a MOOC platform for this country. And then we've kind of been waiting since then to see, you know, the platform develop and what courses will be on it. So now it's been launched. We have around sort of 20 courses initially. They're sort of normal kind of time scale, I suppose, for MOOCs, you know, around about sort of 7-10 weeks, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Although there's no certification for the MOOCs, and obviously, you know, that's kind of the next sort of step with some of these platforms is trying to find ways to certify what you do on them so you can then use that, you know, on your CV and try and get a job. That may, you know, may happen in the future, I guess. I mean, what to make of it, I suppose, you know, it's something that maybe they should have been doing a while ago, the UK universities.
Is it going to be difficult to catch up? I mean, Coursera and edX are doing some quite amazing things.
Yeah, and obviously some UK universities did want to get involved a lot sooner. Edinburgh got involved with one of the US platforms. University of London did that through their international program. So there has been some sort of chomping at the bit, I suppose, to get involved. That is the risk, really, that they've kind of left it so late that, I mean, I suppose my concern is there going to be a global appeal for this platform? I mean, I think we were looking at the launch today that they were talking about, you know, like dozens of countries where students have shown interest already, so maybe that's going to work out. But that would be my concern. I mean, the US platforms are so famous around the world. Mm. Is there a concern that this will just end up being something that works in the UK, really, when that's really the point of it, is the kind of is global reach?
There was an interesting point this morning that David Willetts made when he was talking to a few journalists, which was he was saying that it'll need to be British, but in the way like the Olympics was British, kind of something traditional but also very inclusive, and that draws in the rest of the world. So there's obviously an effort to try and make FutureLearn something that is, you know, based around the reputation of UK universities. But I think there's also a bit of a sense that perhaps the UK had no choice but to do something, given the reputation, given that we were up there in all the rankings alongside the US.
Yeah.
I think Martin Bean, so the OU Vice Chancellor, he called MOOCs the digital storefront of universities in the future. So I think there's a sense that if you don't have one, then you're in trouble, rather than necessarily it being that you might really want to go out and do this.
But that doesn't imply that the UK needs to have its own platform, though, does it? I mean, as long as the UK universities are involved on some platform.
Exactly. I suppose, really, that begs the question, is it being treated as a kind of, like, as you said, a shop window, a marketing tool to try and promote UK universities as a brand around the world, really, rather than an actual platform that's going to turn into a good business model in the future? I mean, something like the US platforms are really trying to innovate and think about ways that it might turn this into a moneymaker, really, now. Yeah. I don't see FutureLearn as that at the moment. I see it as a like you say, as a way of creating a reputation, you know, enhancing the reputation of UK universities, possibly.
It's interesting that it is a business, it is a company, and storefront's probably quite a good metaphor, because Willetts has expressed frustration before that universities are quite unwieldy in the way they make decisions, and they can't raise finance and attract investors because they're charities.
Yeah.
So FutureLearn being a business, being a company, is exactly what he wants in many ways, and it would be interesting to see whether it is more sort of dynamic and successful in promoting UK higher education overseas than the traditional charitable universities.
I think that is being seen in that way at the moment, rather than a way to make money in itself, definitely. And the other thing that Willetts talks about a lot is that it can be used as a replacement for agents, really, so that you'll cut out the middleman. People trying to get students in India and China to come here, but instead they see the MOOC for a university, like the course, and then apply to that university. Mm. It's interesting how that's the angle they're taking, rather than they're going to use this as a business.
Yeah, and there's still debate about that, but what seemed to be the mood this morning anyway was that either way it's going to be a game changer. There's not really any going back once people have started doing this, but I guess we'll have to wait and see. Well, you can read more about that on pages 6 and 7 of this week's magazine, and I'm sure it's an issue that lots of people will be talking about out there on social media as well, so please do get involved. Now, moving on to your piece, John, it seems that the NUS are trying to get some assurances out of the government that the graduates will not pay any more if the student loan book is sold. Do tell us more.
That's right. So this is Tony Pearce, who's the new president of the National Union of Students. And she said she'd met recently with David Willetts, and she thinks that a deal is very close, whereby the government will commit in writing to the fact that it won't change the terms and conditions for graduates who have student loans if the student loan book is sold to a private buyer, which is what the government wants to do. So Tony Pearce said she's very optimistic and seemed very positive about the meeting that there had been with David Willetts. And it was also interesting that when I asked her about the next election and about the Liberal Democrat MPs who broke the NUS's pledge that they would oppose fee rises at the last election, she stuck a very different note from Liam Burns, the last president, in saying that implying that the NUS might leave it to Labour to take that fight to the Lib Dems, and that it's not going to be the NUS taking the front line. So it sounds like she's got a strategy kind of worked out, but it might be more low key than you'd expect.
Interesting. And on the graduate loan book, what's the fear then that might happen? So this gets sold to a private company, and then existing graduates would have to pay back more?
Yeah, that's right. So the government did commission a report from Rothschild Investment Bank in 2011, which recommended, it evaluated exactly that as one of the options, that because the current scheme is quite generous to graduates in not charging them huge repayments, it's not very attractive to banks who might want to buy it. Mm-hmm. So how would you make it more attractive to a bank? Well, you might ask the graduates to be paying more into the loan scheme. So Rothschild looked at that option, but that's something that the NUS wants the government to absolutely commit to ruling out.
Well, as a person still paying off my student loan, I'll be very keen to see how this works out. But and how is Tony Pearce doing in her first few months in the role? What's the reception been to her?
Well, certainly at the Universities UK conference last week, she got extremely good reception. She made a speech really trying to challenge vice-chancellors by saying they should be intellectual leaders in society, and that it should be vice-chancellors who are on question time rather than Russell Brand and David Starkey. And surprisingly, this is a message that seemed to go down well with vice-chancellors, perhaps because she's different to them. She's not a grey middle-aged man, so it seemed to be something that they were quite excited by. And she was even told by one vice-chancellor that hers was the best speech of the entire conference. That can't have been music to the ears of the University of UK president.
Indeed, brilliant. Well, thank you very much, John. That story is on page 9, so you can hear a bit more of what Tony Pearce had to say. And finally, Paul, you've been looking at an idea that might save a few of the millions that the government reportedly spends on consultants. What's this all about?
I have, yes. Tom Brooks, who's a reader in law at Durham University, wrote on the LSE's British Politics and Policy blog recently, suggesting that the government's huge annual bill for private consultants, which, depending on who you believe, ranges somewhere between 500 and 800 million, could be drastically reduced if academics rather than consultancy firms were given the contracts. And also, you know, he also thinks, naturally he would say that, that academics would give better advice anyway. It seems an interesting idea. I mean, in some ways it's a fairly obvious idea, but then I guess, it runs up against the old problems of academics not speaking in a language that politicians can understand, or indeed working to a timescale that politicians can deal with. And I suppose the question is whether those issues could be overcome. I mean, he's certainly very confident that they could. He sees academics sort of getting themselves together into sort of semi-permanent groupings that could move quickly to bid for contracts.
And would the incentives be there, do you think, for academics? I mean, we already know there's a problem that, you know, teaching perhaps doesn't get the focus it should have because of that, and perhaps, you know, working with businesses. Why would working with the government be any different?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I asked him that. He thinks that partly, particularly for people who are doing very policy-focused research, that this would be... it would not only potentially lead to research papers in its own right, but more generally it would give those people a better sense of exactly how policy works and, you know, how these things actually translate into reality.
So it would feed back into their research itself.
Exactly, yeah. And then from the university's point of view, well, apart from having sort of, you know, academics with that experience, he sees the university sort of getting a bit of money from the government. I mean, not huge amounts, but something over and above the cost of buying out the academics' time for whatever time period it was. So they'd have a bit of a financial incentive as well. And they'd also be able to say to potential students, look, our academics are, you know, getting out into the real world and really putting this stuff into practice.
You could probably extend the idea to universities themselves. Why don't they save some of the money they spend on consultants by actually getting some advice from their own academics? So why spend big money on some expensive marketing, PR, branding consultants when you've got kind of marketing experts working for you already?
Indeed. I'm sure he'd get a lot of agreement with that.
You're not thinking of that recent story you did about the University of Essex, are you, by any chance?
Did set something off in my mind. Yeah. I think someone mentioned...
Would academics come up with the Challenger Lighthouse? Who knows? I don't know.
They could come up with something even better, perhaps.
Well, indeed, absolutely. Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Paul. You can read about that on page 22. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us. As ever, we'd welcome your feedback on any of the issues that we've been discussing, or indeed on any of the articles that are in this week's magazine. You can do that on our website, timeshighereducation.co.uk, or find us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, and on Google+. So please do join us for another issue review podcast next week. And until then, thanks for listening.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.